This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's episode 254 with Ingrid LaFleur. She is a curator, an artist, a former mayoral candidate of Detroit, and an Afrofuturist. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images of Ingrid herself, including during her mayoral candidacy run. There's also a great billboard in her curation that floats in the middle of downtown Detroit that says, "There are black people in the future." So go check that out at the website. You can also, of course, check out the back episodes and support the show financially. And we talk about Afrofuturism quite a bit, although that did not make it into the final cut. We just didn't have time. So that will be shared as a bonus episode in the near future. In any case, we did talk about her mayoral run and what is relevant to art. We talked about the Detroit art scene, which tends to be rather segregated. It's a rather segregated city, as you may know. But she really dives into the situation with the Detroit art scene, in particular that divide and how to best address it. So that and so much more to come. Stick around on the back end, and I'll talk to you then.
She really, specific. I majored in art history, but I would focus on art and law issues and censorship issues. So I was really more into art and social justice in college. And then I became an independent curator, and I did that for over 15 years. And it wasn't until I created the curatorial project Afrotopia that I started really wanting to create these kinds of spaces of reflection, reconnection, that I found to be very important because of my work within Afrofuturism. And that's when I started making artwork. But I have always been very, without me consciously, I think, understanding that or being able to articulate that I've always been into social justice, I just really wanted artists to have ultimate freedom and freedom to express, to document, to do the research and investigate. And the reason is because artists tend to give us a very sometimes unbiased, sometimes biased perspective on our lives, on the present moment. But I think more than anything, we can learn so much from the artwork that is produced because of the deep investigation that usually occurs.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, you're mentioning that your advocacy for artists. It seems like your advocacy is broader than that, too.
Right. I think that as a child, I would make artwork, but it was never taken seriously.
As most child artwork is.
Right. And so I always felt like I was like a wannabe artist for a long, long, long time.
Mm.
And I was almost jealous of artists who could curate because they have an inside understanding of art making.
Mm-hmm.
That I had been making art, but I just hadn't thought that I could go deeper into it. But more than anything, it's the ability to imagine. And that's where it begins. You're thinking, you're imagining, and then you go into investigation mode, research mode.
Mm-hmm.
And then you express that thing from what, you know, for all the things that you've gathered. And I felt like that is something that adults need more access to, imagining, play.
Right.
Just pure exploration and experimentation. So as I grew older, I started to see how the adult world doesn't allow for that level of experimentation. And so as a result, I really wanted, I kind of was looking for ways to kind of expand an adult's experience. And as a curator, you kind of think of these things often because you're thinking about how does the audience receive that which I'm putting together and how are they going to engage it and how will it hopefully challenge their own worldview, expand it, but hopefully make them think over and beyond any limitations and boundaries we set for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this is why I really love Afrofuturism. Is within that space that I decided that we could really push adults into exploring and becoming more visionary. But then that's when I realized that it's such a privilege to be able to have the time and space to imagine.
Mm. When you think of the typical target person that you want to advocate for, you know, that you were sort of alluding to, what does that profile look like? I mean, are we talking about somebody who is the type of person who says, oh, I could never do art, you know, that kind of person? Or are you talking about maybe a even wider scope?
Yeah, I think that it is, I think it's maybe the person who might be a little curious about art,
mm-hmm.
and what it can do and how maybe, you know, they would have loved to have engaged with it more, but just didn't have the ability or time or the permission to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Our society doesn't really give us permission to engage art. We don't see it as a serious position or job. Most people don't think that you can make money from it. So as a result, it gets pushed aside. And so our passion, any creative passion that we have isn't being nurtured or cultivated as a result of that. But I think that, you know, anyone and everyone, even if you're a person who engages in kind of creative exercises, anyone could actually really benefit from just constantly expanding that and really kind of probing that even further. So I think no matter what industry that you're in, having a vision and, you know, imagining in order to have that vision can be very, very helpful. And this is why I've become a futurist.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, I mean, I'm really interested in the fact that you ran for mayor of Detroit, because it seems like, in light of what we're talking about, that maybe in some ways could have been a way to spread the word that you're referring to a lot of people, right? So what was the impetus for that move, and what was that process like?
Running for mayor.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when I realized the privilege of imagining and taking the time to kind of really even consider a future, I understood that it was impeded by the fact that people are economically struggling or disadvantaged in some way, shape, or form. And as a result, their world is just completely consumed by the need to make money and to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that poverty cycle that comes about, and even kind of stretching that into middle income, is really like the squeezing that happens.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a lot of it is as a result of government and our policies.
Yeah.
And so as a result of me kind of coming to that understanding, albeit to me pretty late in my adult life, I was in my mid-30s by the time I understood this, I really started seeking out, how are people kind of already addressing these challenges? What is the social justice community already doing? And really wanting to just sit and listen. And then once I understood that there are already many different kind of resolutions that were put forth towards any government, but were not taken seriously or completely ignored, I just became really frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a very impatient person. So if I know that there is a logical solution to a thing, then I'm very, very much wanting to just kind of implement that thing immediately. And especially if that thing is causing harm, I don't know why we don't stop it in its tracks like yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, me running for mayor was a way to really kind of get out in front of the thing and making sure that our residents of Detroit understand there's many different solutions, many different possibilities to address these issues that are plaguing our city. And our politicians are not brave enough to put forth these solutions simply because they're thinking about votes.
Right.
And as a person who, yes, definitely seriously ran for mayor, but I was more concerned about our residents than votes, I have this freedom to be able to introduce different ideas and explore how do we end the poverty cycle so that we can have a more prosperous future collectively.
Mm-hmm.
And that process, you know, it's a crazy world of political system. There's unspoken rules to some degree about, like, how do you dress? How do you address people? How do you come off as a politician? But the thing about it is most people don't trust politicians. So then as a curator, you know, I'm trying to figure out how can I seem more accessible so that people can actually approach me and talk to me? You know, how do I make that happen? And how do I make sure that you take me seriously and hear what I'm saying, but then at the same time, you trust me?
Mm-hmm.
It's a tricky balance. Also, being a non-traditional political candidate, it was very, it was a debate in the campaign room about when to kind of introduce certain ideas because I was already kind of labeled radical.
Right.
So one of those ideas was the universal basic income.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to introduce a cryptocurrency that Detroit would create that we could strengthen our local economy and create that universal basic income and really become less dependent on state and federal governments and the money that comes in from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's huge and lofty, but it's doable. It's very possible. We have the technology to make it happen. And even if we don't create a universal basic income, just thinking about how blockchain technology can create more efficiency in our systems and the documents that we hold in terms of, you know, how we track deeds, for instance, or birth certificates, marriage licenses, all of these things could be put on a blockchain, which will then lessen the bureaucracy that we have, most people are dealing with, which takes time and money to go through. Mm-hmm. And most people, if you're, you know, Detroit, 64%, poverty rate, we don't have the time or the resources to go through
mm-hmm.
Any sort of hiccups or mistakes. These mistakes, people lose homes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just kind of trying to figure out how can we tackle and make sure that government is not contributing to the demise of our residents, I think is really, really, really important. We should be fighting and upholding and really, quite honestly, loving our residents instead of always being in competition or in battle or in debate with them.
It seems like the blockchain, you know, as a solution to those kinds of issues and you know, money, bureaucracy, affordability, et cetera, is still early enough along that it's a tough sell. You know, that was the sense that I got from talking to Ruth Catlow as well. So what was your experience with voters and, you know, running for mayor as far as that goes?
Yeah, I definitely proposed that last universal basic income with a local cryptocurrency maybe 3 weeks before the primary vote. And I did, you know, older Black men probably were my toughest critics,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to talk to some of them, and they were like, you know what, that's a really, really good idea, but nobody will let it happen.
Mm-hmm. But getting back to you and your mayoral candidacy and run, do you feel like it was encouraging enough to do it again, or if not, are there some takeaways you have that you're applying to your arts advocacy and, you know, and other things like that?
Yeah. I would only do it again if I were able to have access to a lot of money.
Right.
Because I would want to campaign in a way that uses a lot of the tax and kind of experiment with new campaigning models.
Mm-hmm.
that really I haven't seen implemented at all. So I would, that would be something of interest to me, because I notice little things like voters, they take a card and it has all the info on it and then they throw it away or it ends up on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, and they barely read it. They read like 2 points, ask you about maybe one, and then they're done. Then, you know, there's different tactics that I don't know if voters are really that excited about or engaged, but they're age-old tactics. I personally am more interested in consulting politicians because so many of them don't have future vision. So many of them don't understand what's going on with the tech and how it could be beneficial for their government systems. And a lot of them don't really understand how people are creating their own trajectory about how they want government to exist and be in their lives and how we could possibly kind of change or shift certain parts of it in order to accommodate that. And I think one of the things that I definitely had in my head, and I think that most politicians need to remember, is that they're administrators.
Right.
They're literally working for you.
Right.
They should not be the power base. And it's unfair that the power has shifted to them and not, you know, and it's been taken away from the people. And of course, we've been talking about this for decades, if not centuries. And so it's been a long, long issue. But now we have the technologies to basically balance that out. I mean, instead of being afraid of losing power as a government system, really should just understand that it's just going to be a shared power system in the future and just kind of, you know, be open to that and really understand, okay, well, what does that mean in terms of city services?
Do you have the ears of the current mayor?
There are people that work for him. I have their ears.
Okay, that's close enough, right?
Yeah.
All right, I'm sort of getting from you that while this sort of crazy AI dystopic type work is going on, that you're involved in a thinking that's more grassroots and oriented towards everybody, towards a more democratic way of solving the problem. Is that, do you feel like that's going at a level of engagement and activity that is equal to, in some ways, the more dystopic tech sort of side of things?
Yeah, I think that as many people there as there are who are, you know, creating this kind of alternative reality where a techopia in a way. There are definitely grassroots workers who are countering that, for sure. But as you stated, money is a big, big factor. Huge factor. We're talking about billions compared to activists hoping to get, you know, 10 grand even. You know? Like begging foundations for, you know, thousands of dollars. Compared to billions, there's that's a problem. And you also have, so those are people who are paying attention, right? Majority of the people are not paying attention and have no understanding of the tech that exists and how it works. So right now in Detroit, we're dealing with facial recognition software, where it already will analyze a black woman and mistakenly identify her as a man 31% of the time. And this is in a city that's 85% black and women are the majority and head of households. So mistaken identity, thinking about poverty cycle, could completely upend a family. And the ripple effect can be enormous. And so, you know, you have activists who in Detroit, like Tawana Petty, who are on the front lines trying to convince our city council that this is not a good idea, trying to convince the mayor, trying to talk to police commissioners and convince them this is not the route that we want to take because the tech is faulty. And we're talking about research from MIT. Like, it's not like, it's pretty, you know, substantial. The problem is it's hard to get the groundswell because majority of Detroit residents don't even know their facial recognition software is coming to Detroit, don't know how it works, don't know what it means when there's a mistaken identity, all of these things. So as a result, you're not going to get like the public and the numbers that are necessary to make the change. So facial recognition software, that specific software, has been adopted by our police department, you know.
Right.
So that it becomes that, like, the digital literacy or the just the literacy around emerging tech is really important, and that's the missing piece.
Mm-hmm. It seems like your arts advocacy is definitely rooted in the local, right, with Detroit. Mm-hmm. But then you are going to be traveling abroad for Afrofuturism workshops, correct, too. And I'm just, as you're saying all these things about, you know, what we need and activism and the money problem, you know, especially in comparison to tech and so on, I wonder to what extent, you know, your arts advocacy can involve addressing some of those money problems. Like, I mean, obviously the biggest problem is the way the capitalism is structured, especially right now, right? I mean, so that seems to be a whole, you know, world of, or a whole job unto itself, you know, to get involved in that side of things. Do you feel like you're able to integrate that kind of activism into the various projects that you're doing? You know what I mean? Or does that feel like another, you know, a different piece?
Yeah, it's all intertwined. Mm-hmm. I'm giving a workshop in Essen, Germany for Impact, which is a conference that happens every year. And the workshop that I'm giving will be looking at how to create a new economy. So I believe in community currencies, these kind of community-developed microeconomies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is where the direction we should be going, and globally.
Mm-hmm.
And there, you can find pockets of that all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be visiting Nairobi, for instance, that launched a community currency last year on the blockchain.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I really want to see how that's going. But, of course, Kenya is leading the way when it comes to using mobile devices for exchange of currencies.
Mm-hmm.
So we're moving in this direction already. My concern is that, in terms of how I bring everything together, is it with what mindset are we creating this new economy? Because if we don't unpack that, we're literally going to recreate the capitalist model,
right,
that has already excluded majority of us, right?
Right, right.
So how do we create an economy that just hyper-inclusive, beneficial, and really beneficial to our communities, but really reflects the values of our community?
Mm-hmm.
We have never been able to even consider this or think about it on this level until now, because of the introduction of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from an art background and now working in tech and finance, number one, I didn't think that I would be here at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was completely intimidated by it. But then number two, I come to understand how much I don't know.
Right.
And how a disservice that has been for me individually, personally, and how I understand how disempowering that is for, like, collectively, for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really participating in this economic system kind of blind.
Right.
All we know is that in order for me to eat and have comfortable shelter and, you know, a car, all the things that I want, I need this thing, this green paper.
Right.
That's all I know.
Yeah.
And I need to do everything possible to get it. Sometimes I'm compromising that my values, and sometimes I'm not. And this system, unfortunately, rewards me either way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, I think that a lot of us would love at least the option to use a currency that has a different value set that won't perpetuate this kind of economic violence that capitalism perpetuates.
Right, right.
And won't be an extraction of resources. Instead, it would hopefully create a level of joy, because now we're able to have access to resources collectively without creating any harm. And we know that from the core. I think that possibility is really wonderful. And that's what my workshops really are about. It's that, hey, we have the possibility to create these community-developed economies, but let's make sure that we're in the right mindset.
Mm-hmm.
So it really doesn't matter if you're German, the next workshop will be in Rwanda, or if you're in the United States. We all need to check ourselves, because we've all of our societies and cultures are embedded with different values or perspectives or ways of engaging the exchange of resources that we probably don't like. And so it's really about confronting that, I think. And that's what my workshop will help do, is help us to unearth those things, confront it, and then combat it with the creation of a new economy.
Yeah, and speaking of a new economy, when you mentioned that you were intimidated by, you know, getting into this blockchain space earlier, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's kind of the automatic question that comes up with artists and blockchain, and certainly with you. To what extent have you been acclimating yourself to that space, or getting knowledgeable about that format?
Right.
On a technical level, yeah. Versus more yeah. just of a, yeah. you know, social level, I guess. Because, you know, I can see
right.
two obvious strains. You know, there's the one that's like, okay, blockchain is this system, you know, that can be used for an alternative economy, and you're coming from it, or you're coming to it from that place. And or you're coming from it as a real tech person, you know, who understands, you know, almost like an engineer, the technical machinations, which are very complicated still to most of us who have not really spent much time there.
Yeah, I am very open about the fact that I had no understanding of blockchain technology when I proposed my universal basic income
mm-hmm,
plan.
Mm-hmm.
And decided after Rob Ponsdorf, he's very well respected in the blockchain industry, really young, he's still in his 20s, sat me down and explained to me the philosophies behind blockchain technology, why Bitcoin was created, and why other blockchain were created. The philosophy part of it really, really helped to frame things. And I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't even think about that, that the creators of the tech, of any of the tech, might have a particular ethos.
And ethos.
So
mm-hmm.
with that, you know, that was helpful in understanding the tech moving forward. It took me a while, because techies don't really explain things in plain English.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I found myself to be most useful.
Mm-hmm.
So I became the chief community officer for EOS Detroit. And EOS Detroit is a block producer for the blockchain EOS.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my responsibility to basically introduce blockchain technology to Detroit. And I have to say myself, pretty good at it, simply because I'm not a techie.
Mm-hmm.
So I only know how to talk about things in plain English.
Right.
I don't have all the language and vocab together, and nor do I feel the need to get it down pat when teaching people, the everyday person, about blockchain technology. You know, there is always this debate about how much do you teach people about blockchain. How much do they really need to know? Because it is a back-end technology.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. When the internet came out, and till to now, nobody really understands how the internet works.
Mm-hmm.
But we're using it on a daily basis, like yeah. every day,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
Yeah. But nobody understands how it works. But because we don't understand how it works, Facebook wasn't able to make billions of dollars off of us. So I think it's really important for us to have some sort of framing around blockchain technology, because one, it's going to disrupt different industries, and people need to be prepared about how their job might evolve, right? So it's kind of like everyone had to learn word processing on a computer. So it's that kind of thing. So if you're an accountant, if you're a lawyer, if you're dealing in supply chains, you have to know blockchain technology. That's one really big thing for me, because people are not as flexible with their jobs and their skill set necessarily. So we have to make sure that people are prepared for any changes, and hopefully they can become prepared. And I think the other thing is that by not going maybe one step further than explaining that it's a digital ledger, it's just like any ledger that an accountant would use, except it's digital, and it's secure because of the cryptography, going one step further about how it can be used, we can have automated contracts on a blockchain, or, you know, we can have decentralized autonomous communities, which are basically digital cooperatives on a blockchain, and how it just basically organizes and creates efficiency. I think that that's one, that's another layer to it. But then going even deeper, just a touch further, I think could be helpful for people who might be interested in going even further and didn't know it, right? Because of the lack of exposure to the average resident of the United States, because we don't have it really in schools, we're not really teaching people about all the emerging tech that's happening. When there is a level of exposure, you never know. You might have somebody who wants to go into the industry and dive in deep. So I like to empower people with enough knowledge to make any and all of those decisions about how they want to engage the tech.
Right.
And I focus more on blockchain technology than cryptocurrency, because I think that's the mama. Blockchain technology is the big baby that has the ability to do all of these other things. And so I think it's a good starting point. Yeah. And but then, you know, it's, what's interesting about blockchain technology, the industries, the emerging tech industries are very siloed. So AI is over here. VR, XR might be in another category. Blockchain, another category. And they don't really like to mix together or connect, at least a lot of the people working in each industry. As the artist, though, I'm noticing that we kind of mix them and bounce around. And I think that that's important, because they do and will kind of inform each other in some way, shape, or form. They need to know how, and that's the exciting part.
Let me just briefly address what I would imagine is a common skepticism, you know, from people who are only mildly or barely familiar with blockchain technology, is that it's hackable, right? You know, if the choices are an analog world, which is obviously a bit of a myth because, so you know, our analog world is so digital now, but if it's some version of that, versus putting things in this blockchain that's completely digital and as skeptics would think, hackable, what would be your demystification or response to that issue?
Well, one, it's not hackable, and it hasn't been hacked.
Wow, really?
Entities, no. But entities that have been built from it have been hacked. But the blockchains themselves haven't been hacked yet.
Okay.
And so that's important to know. I think that the cryptography part of it is the focus, and that's why entities like JP Morgan created their own digital token for internal use, because they understand the level of security that it provides, and then it and the level of organization. So it's transparent in that you can just go back into the blockchain and see all the transactions that happen. It's wonderfully, you know, efficient in that way.
I basically just want, I guess I just wanted to ask you about one last thing, or sort of talk about one last topic, and that is Detroit, being, you know, that you ran for mayor there, you're a citizen there. Did you, have you spent a lot of your life there?
I'm born and raised Detroiter.
Got it.
I did leave when I was 18 and returned in my 30s.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I've been home for about 10 years now. So I have a deep, long relationship.
So I think there was somebody that I spoke with at some point on the podcast about the potential of artists moving to Detroit. Yeah, it was with an arts writer, actually, because it was such a great city for affordability and creativity and, you know, even a burgeoning art community. And I don't get that many responses from listeners, but one person who didn't necessarily strike me as a regular listener responded in such a way as to suggest that don't let people come here. We don't want them. Something to that effect. So I guess I wonder if that sounds familiar to you. You know, the whole New York exodus from New York or other maybe Eastern board cities to Detroit, and then that it would become gentrified, you know, and head down that evil path. What your experience with that is and where the art scene is these days generally in Detroit.
Yeah, so, wow, there's so much to that. Yes, artists have been moving to Detroit. Majority of them are white American artists, which means that they're moving to a city that's 85% black.
Yeah.
Which means that they are not the center. They become a minority the minute that they land in our city.
Mm-hmm.
They can find the enclave of whiteness, of course,
mm-hmm.
but you could feel when you have those white Americans who are still afraid of the black body, black and brown bodies.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll be very specific in saying black bodies,
mm-hmm.
Because there's less engagement with black people in terms of moving into certain areas or frequenting restaurants. So a black-owned restaurant that is known to be black-owned is more likely to have a black patron base.
Mm-hmm.
But a white-owned restaurant will have a mainly white patron base.
Mm-hmm.
A black-owned restaurant that you don't know is black, like we have a Japanese restaurant that's owned by a black man here,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you will find it's a majority white patron base. It's fascinating, the level of segregation. And that divide feels like it goes deeper when you have white people who aren't, who were not ready to engage with blackness.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you know, white Americans are raised the idea that they don't have to engage with blackness.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that you have people moving to your neighborhood who will downright and completely ignore you, avoid eye contact, and even if you still say hello, will not respond.
Wow.
There's many, many, many cases of that. You can just look at the Facebook feeds. It's ridiculous.
Mm.
And it's all that does is just speak to the larger American problem that we have with race.
So,
in Detroit, it makes it more acute. If we can understand that, because it is a majority black city.
Right.
So I can see why some people are just like, please don't come.
Yeah.
Well,
I was just going to ask.
Cause some challenges.
I was just going to ask. So, virtually all, if not all, of the white colonizers or the white exit, you know, people who are leaving other cities, New York or wherever, and coming to Detroit as artists, none of them or very few of them are good stewards of being new neighbors.
I don't know if we can say that, but what we can say is that we're getting a high level people new to Detroit who don't seem to understand how to engage with black bodies. So it doesn't even matter if they're artists or not.
Mm-hmm.
The art world here tend to be highly segregated. So you have a white art world and you have a black art world.
Wow.
We have a Latinx in our world.
Wow.
We're culturally segregated, even though there is a lot of Black, Brown, and Indigenous solidarity here in the activist space.
Mm-hmm.
And artists, a lot of the artists of color tend to be activists as well. So there's that, like, you know, fluidity.
Mm-hmm.
But when I first came here as a curator, if I were to access, or as I was accessing the art world in a very traditional way. Like, where are the galleries? Where are the museums? And it was just all white all the time.
Right.
And it wasn't until I got deeper into the social justice space that I found the other artists, Black artists mm-hmm. and Latinx artists. And I was like, oh, okay, that is. But it took a minute. It mm-hmm. took a minute.
Mm-hmm.
It really shouldn't take that long in the 85% Black city. But on a commercial market level, at the time, it was just majority white artists that were being shown and being supported. Unless you went to Georgia Nnamdi's gallery, which is Black-owned and shows Black artists. But as you can see, I just named one Black gallery.
Yeah.
So you know, you would think in an 85% Black city, we would have multiple. We don't. We don't have that many at all. We have Del Prior. We have Georgia Nnamdi and a couple of smaller art spaces. And Norwest Gallery. And that's it. So it makes it very difficult. And our art market is very small here in Detroit, mm-hmm. in the Midwest in general. We're not mm-hmm. tapping into that market like Chicago is.
Right.
So that makes it a little difficult for artists. Some artists move here and then leave because they couldn't maybe make the money that they want to make. So it's really a place for practice, like to build your practice more so and maybe stabilize with a studio space that you might own. As opposed to really making money and entering the market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're trying to change that. There's a group of art advocates, who've come together and created United Artists of Detroit, and I'm part of that group. And we are in the midst of creating a database so that artists can be easily found by businesses and arts administrators and curators and anybody who is in need of any sort of creative, all industries will be represented. So this is our step one into how do we grow the visibility of all artists to be as inclusive about that, and making sure that there's a connecting point, a portal for those who want to, you know, hire and support artists or curate artists. Work with, you know, Detroit artists.
Mm-hmm. To what extent are you currently or recently moving through both or various art worlds? I mean, it sounds like you were sort of trying to invest in the white art world to some extent or participate in it, and then you moved towards the social activist space and became more integrated into the Black art world of Detroit. To what extent are you consciously trying to meander or interact throughout all of them?
Yeah, I definitely move in and out of all the art world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a social butterfly in that way.
Right.
And I have friends in all these different spaces from all backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to keep a pulse on everything that's going on. And I recently curated an exhibition at the Library Street Collective, which is located downtown. So the gallery itself is white-owned. I've known the owners for quite a while, JJ and Anthony Chiris. And they have definitely developed a gallery program that has deeply diversified over the years. But their location is downtown, which is at a 99% occupancy rate, and is majority white.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have all the hotels. You have all these visitors who are majority white.
Mm-hmm.
So I hesitated to curate an exhibition downtown, which is away from the neighborhoods, which are away from the communities that I'm active in and care about.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that I said yes is because I wanted to really make sure that Black Detroiters understood that downtown Detroit is still Detroit,
mm-hmm.
and that it's still our city.
Mm-hmm.
It's still accessible to us. It should be, and available to us.
Right.
And so I had a billboard that was up over Queen's Bar that says, "There are Black people in the future." And that was the start of the exhibition. And that marker was really important to make sure that those who wanted to be in that bubble, their little white bubble, understand that you're in a Black city, mm-hmm. and that we are here. We're not going to go anywhere. So all the restaurants that tend to be a little hostile because they're not used to dealing with Black patrons, mm-hmm. Are just going to have to figure it out.
Right.
And that we're not just going to be here in the future. We're going to be powerful, thriving, loving, joy and enjoy. So it's just not going to be struggle mode here.
Yeah.
We're ending that era now.
Right.
And so, it's... So being at Library Street Collective with this Afrofuturist exhibition kind of addressed another thing that I think is really important, and which is ending the fear of the Black body for white-bodied people. We really need that to happen so that we can start humanizing Black bodies,
mm-hmm.
and then when we're voting for policies and have an understanding of how that's affecting everyone, right? And then that means that you're fully engaging the city because it's a Black city. and it's a great city. That's why you moved here. Or
right.
That's why you're visiting.
Right.
Because it's a really fun, amazing city with really good, good, fun people. And it's pretty. It's a really pretty city. So.
So maybe you can add Chamber of Commerce to one of your many hats, right? I'm just thinking, are there other cities in the Midwest where that maybe the prior division, of race has those walls have come down a bit? I recently heard a conversation with a guy who recently moved to Columbus, and he was... I don't know if he explicitly described healthy interrace dynamics, but he did describe it as a city that was really inviting, and that was sort of maybe implied. You know what I mean? It sounds like there's a lot of time before that's going to happen in Detroit, but is that something that people include that as part of their activism, trying to, it sounds like to some extent you're doing that through your curating, but I wonder if there's even maybe a more active version of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion, sometimes it's a joke, sometimes it's not, about having trainings or workshops for people who are moving to Detroit so that they have an understanding of what culture that they moved into.
Yeah.
I think that is a serious proposition, and that it really would speak to, how deep our racial tension goes, mm-hmm. and how so many of us don't want to confront those issues,
right?
And rather not have to deal with it and just be like, all lives matter, and just keep it pushing.
Oh God.
and I understand but I understand it's difficult. We got a lot going on in our lives as individuals, and so to add something to the plate can be annoying.
Yeah.
Also, you can understand that historically a Black person would be trained in how to interact and engage a space, be it a city, an office, or whatever. We come into this world basically trained in how to behave in certain spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that is just to protect ourselves. Now, to start training white people on how to, quote unquote, behave within our space,
right.
Well, that can cause, the power dynamics change, and that causes its own issue. Because whites aren't used to that. At all. They want to remain the center. And I think it's more subconscious than anything, but honestly. So, I think that could be a way to go about it. Really, art is a really wonderful way to engage people and help them expand their minds with maybe some play, a little bit of delight, some fascination. That's why I had virtual reality in my exhibition. Mm-hmm. I had augmented reality. You know, I think all of those things are really wonderful ways to kind of say, hey, Black people, you know, come in all types of ways and shapes and sizes. You know, that's what Afrofuturism does. It expands Blackness so much that you almost can't find it anymore. And I think that that's really helpful in the humanization of the Black body. And once that is established, once a person's relationship and perspective on the Black body expands and becomes healthier and hopefully more loving, then we're moving in the right direction. That's when we're co-creating a future that I think that we all want to live in. And we're like maybe one step closer to our utopia.
Right. But I do want to use the opportunity to imagine a new resident, an artist in particular, coming to Detroit. You know, let's say an artist is living and working somewhere in Brooklyn, right? And they decide, all right, you know, my rent just went up or it's going to go up. I can't do this anymore and I need more space. My space is already too small to begin with. I have a friend in Detroit. I know I can get some serious square footage there. So that person decides to come. They have some awareness of the fact that this is a different city, different environment. They are a interloper of sorts. What is the best course of action to be a benign addition to the city? You know, do they, you know, you mentioned sort of jokingly, you know, mm-hmm. there is no real workshop for people coming into town, but what should that individual look up?
Yeah, I think that we always have ideas when we're entering a city about what we want to do. I think the best thing to do is pause and figure out someone's already doing it. And then if there's a social issue that you want to tackle, pause again and figure out what organizations are working on it. Enter those spaces and humbly listen.
Right.
Just listen. I think that's like the biggest thing, and it just seems to be the hardest thing for a lot of people to do.
Oh, God, yeah.
Just listen. Yeah, because there's so many beautiful gems that can come out of that. And then you can go into a collaboration that could probably be stronger to bring about the thing that you're imagining. But even if it's not a collaboration, you begin building community that way as well. Mm. Because hopefully you're coming in with a sincerity to really understand and learn and contribute to a to an issue or a challenge or a problem.
Right.
I think, you know, that is the thing that we usually like to tell people when they move to Detroit, is just chill out, explore, learn as much as possible before activating a thing.
Mm.
I even did that. I am born and raised Detroiter. My dad is from Detroit.
Mm.
But when I came back home 10 years ago, I spent 1 year not traveling, which is rare for me. I'm very, 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 mm-hmm. very nomadic.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 1 year not traveling and just getting lost in Detroit, rediscovering my hometown, introducing myself to neighborhoods that I'd never known about before. And then just kind of meeting people and figuring out different events and just going and sitting and just kind of absorbing and just becoming reacquainted, because Detroit honestly was completely different from when I grew up here. So just really understanding, because all the issues that we're dealing with now, we didn't deal with before when I was a child. So I have to like understand that we had the issue in the first place. Like, oh my God, there's children living without water in Detroit.
Mm.
Oh my goodness, you know. So it was like lots of shock that I had to deal with and and come down from first.
Right.
But then after that, it's really important to see how people are addressing that issue. And then you can see, okay, I have this set of skills and I think this could be useful, and kind of humbly offering it to people to say, hey, you know, this is what I have. Do you find this useful? Mm. The colonial way would be, there's an issue. I know how to solve that issue. I'm just going to do it in my own siloed way, aggressively.
Right.
And if I don't like, you know, if you don't like it, or if you're, you know, wanting to debate me about how I'm addressing this issue, I'm going to ignore you, silence you, and just aggressively push it through.
Yeah.
And this is what we're used to, and this is what we're seeing, and this is what has become normalized.
Yeah.
And so Detroit is very much community oriented. It forces people to create a new method for engaging a city. It's, for me, I've lived in many, many cities. This is the first city that has required this much of me. But I've enjoyed it so much, and I've grown so much, and that's why I employ people who are new to Detroit to go through that process, because you grow so much and your practice will evolve and expand in ways you didn't even see coming. Detroit is very magical in that way.
Mm. Great advice. I hope people take you up on your suggestions.
Thanks.
It was great to talk with you, Ingrid. Thank you so much.
It was great talking to you, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. And we're out. Many thanks again to Ingrid for talking to me. I enjoyed that. I hope you guys did as well. Lot to take in there, right? And there'll be even more because, as I said, we had a conversation within that conversation about Afrofuturism, where she talked about that and all things related. That will be a bonus episode. And indeed, before we get to the old news, I did want to remind you, this is a listener-supported show. Your guys' financial support really does keep this show going. And here is a great opportunity to support this show. If you donate to the show with a one-time donation of $35 or more via PayPal or Venmo, you will get that upcoming Afrofuturist and Ingrid LaFleur episode, along with all of the other 10 bonus episodes of the show. You know, but you can support the show for as little as $1 a month via Patreon, or you can make a one-time donation for as little as, let's say, 15 or 20 bucks. Any donation you can afford would be much appreciated. You can, of course, support the show also by writing a great review on Apple Podcasts, following us on social media at Artist Podcast, and spreading the word about the show. All much appreciated. Big thanks to new member of our podcast team, Adam Vale, who has been providing guidance for me in the show and provided this week's edit, while Andy Davis is in India for this month. Big thanks also to producer Amanda Roth. And now on to the Weisslinks, courtesy of Megan Bickle and myself. Paying $9,000 a year for a degree in fine art and finding out on day one that you aren't going to be given any direction, structure, real skills, or materials, and you just have to figure it all out yourself. That is courtesy of The White Pube. And let's get to the Marciano Math by William Poundstone of the Los Angeles County Museum on Fire blog. How much money would unitization cost the Marciano Art Foundation? A lot less than one Takashi Murakami sculpture. About 70 visitor services employees were laid off after announcing plans to organize a union, essentially. All or nearly all are part-time, earning the city's minimum wage of $14.25 an hour. That would mean the MAF is paying about 70 times 20 hours by 1425, or just shy of $20,000 a week for its greeters, guards, and docents. Let's say collective bargaining would entail wage increases and benefits worth 20% of the current wages. Then unionization would cost the Marcianos about 20% of $20,000, or $4,000 a week. That comes to about $200,000 a year. Yes, that's a lot of money for regular folks, like visitor services employees, but not for those in a position to participate in the high end of the contemporary art market, like the Marcianos. He goes on to talk about Murakami's 3M Girl, one version of which is owned in the collection. Other slutty anime sculptures by Murakami have been auctioned for as much as $13.5 million. Assume a $5 million valuation for the Marciano's 3M girl, and it would be the equivalent of 25 years of union wages. Whatever else you say about the Marciano shutdown, it's hard to avoid the thought. Penny wise, pound foolish. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to speaking to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, ciao for now.